Today's talk continues on the theme of Dharma, the refuge in the Dhamma, as we say in Pali. And giving three talks on the Dharma, the refuge of Dharma, maybe is an indication for how central we think it is to the whole enterprise. And it's many ways I feel a very strong connection or love or faith in the Dharma. It's a very powerful term for me personally, but I think for down through the centuries for many Buddhists, the word Dharma is a very rich, multivalent word that is closely connected to being an article of faith, or not if article is the right word, but something that's sacred, or something that they have deep trust, something that's speaks to some dimension of life that is much bigger than any individual person. There was a I forget who it was, maybe it was Faraday or some of the great scientists of the 1800s who came up with some of the laws of thermodynamics. Didn't come up with them, but understood them. Someone asked this guy, you know, where do you get these understanding, these ideas, these equations, and where do they come from? And he said, something inside of me, which is not myself, came up with them. So he wasn't taking like the personal credit exactly the usual way, which, you know, that I thought it out and figured it out. That something impersonal, or something transpersonal, or something that's bigger than our conscious self, who we think we are. So I think the Dharma kind of points to something bigger than our own efforts, our own understanding, our own self even, and that supports us, that holds us. And that's actually the tradition to say that the reason it's Dharma is it's dharati. And dharati means to hold, to support. And so the etymology of the word is supposed to be that it comes from that which supports or holds up. So that which holds us and supports us. And one of the powerful terms that, little phrases or slogans that comes down to us is the slogan, one who lives by the Dharma is protected by the Dharma. So how can the Dharma protect you? But the one who lives by the Dharma is protected by the Dharma. And when I was thinking about this today, I was a story in my own life that came to mind. I was a Zen monk and I'd gone to Japan to practice Zen, but I had very little money. I had some like $200 to my name, and so I thought it was reasonable to that little money to get a job. And so it was relatively easy to get jobs back then in Japan to teach English. So I had it all set up to teach these English classes. But there was a couple of weeks before those classes started. So what does a Zen monk do without the time on his hands? So I went to sit a sesshin, a seven-day Zen retreat. And and during that retreat, I thought to myself, what am I doing teaching English? I came to Japan to study Zen, to practice Buddhism. That's what I came to do. What am I doing teaching English for? And logically it makes sense, but you know, I thought, I'm going to throw myself in to the Dharma. That's what I'm going to do. So then So eventually I went back to Japan and canceled to Kyoto and canceled my classes, but I was still in the sesshin. And it came to an end, and it was time to say goodbye to the abbot. And you know, was the sesshin was offered freely; nothing was asked of me. And but I, you know, it was, I thought it'd be nice. Also, there was a custom of offering some dana, offering a gift, and you do it a little bit formally in Japan. And so we had to, I put it in a nice little envelope. And I went to his study. I think it was, we were all sitting on the floor, a little table, and kind of formal, and to a translator. And we talked a little bit about my sesshin, and I, he asked about, about me. Oh, in the beginning, I handed him my donation in the envelopes. He didn't know what was in there. He put it on the table. We talked, and I explained that to my story. And my story was that I'd been ordained by an American Zen abbot. But then there was a problem with him, and so he had resigned and left the Zen Center. And so I had become what in Japan is called a Ronin monk. And a Ronin monk is a samurai who doesn't have a master. So I was a masterless monk, which is not a good thing. Or I don't know if that's the right word of it, but you know, then at least like, people feel sorry for you because you're, you know, you're supposed to have a teacher if you're you know, relatively new monk. And so you know, I explained this that I was in Japan and looking for a teacher and I didn't have one, and so he said, "Oh, just a minute," and he disappeared into the back room, and then he came back out with an envelope. And he handed it to me. "This is for you." And he said, "This is train money." Because it turned out in Japan, in the Buddhist circles, there's a custom that if someone's a Ronin monastic, that you give them travel money so they can afford to go around and visit other teachers until they found a teacher. So that was nice. And so then I left. And when I was gone, I opened the envelope, and there was more money in there than I'd given him. So that was a little story about, you know, live the Dharma. You know, I'd made this decision, that's what I was going to do. And so I lived the Dharma, and then look what came, just right at the end of the sesshin. It wasn't like a lot of money, but it was something. And so I found through my life repeatedly, every time I've decided to turn towards the Dharma to practice, it seems like something came along to make it possible, support it. I'm very lucky this way. And I think there's, I feel like through my practice, through practicing, that there's this powerful, I don't know what to call it, force, sensibility. Something operates in this being that I can't, you know, I call it the, you know, I'm happy to call it the Dharma. It's not me exactly. Something inside of me which is not myself. And it operates in all kinds of ways. So when I was here teaching a retreat in June, I went down with my colleague I was teaching with, Paul Haller, and down to the local, there's a little park not about 5 minutes away. And we just went for a walk after, I think after the Dharma talk or something. And we went walking along the Frisbee golf course. And we were watching these, happened to be all guys doing Frisbee. And then we saw started to be an argument between two guys and up in different teams. They weren't playing against each other, just like on the same part of the field. And I thought they were just joking. The joking got stronger. And then they were all out fist fight and wrestling match. And these were two big strong guys. It was June, they had big muscles, and both of them were like, wow. So, you know, what to do? They're on the ground, and so I didn't know what to do. So I walked towards them. And this walking towards them was the Dharma. I felt certainly intimidated by these big, strong guys. I'm not very strong. I might be tall and imposing to some people, but I'm, you know, I don't know how to fight. So something, you know, I wouldn't even say that I had no choice. That's to say too much. It's just what I did. I just walked towards it and to see what would happen. And then when I was about, I don't know, pretty close, close for me was maybe 10 feet away from the fight, they had their buddies there, and so their buddies came down and pulled them apart, and I was saved. Not by the Dharma, but by the buddies. those who live by the Dharma are protected by the Dharma. I think it's a powerful statement, and it points to the faith or the trust in something. And a little bit more central to the tradition is because it's in the liturgy, it's chanted daily by people who do the chanting, is the definition or the description of the Dhamma, where it's said to be the Dharma is visible here and now, it's immediate, it invites us to come and look here. It's onward leading, and it's to be experienced by the wise. So the Dharma is visible here and now. Even though you can talk about it kind of strange ways, it's in the heart, it protects us and all that, it's also something that's kind of to be experienced by the wise, to be visible. It's here and now. It's not somewhere else. And it's immediate. There's something about the Dharma which its benefits, its realizations, understanding. There's some way that it's immediate. It's not like something you have to wait years to encounter or years to attain. It's something about the immediacy of now, which is at the heart of it. And then that it's on. It invites inspection, invites us to come and look. Okay, here, come look. I think it's a beautiful idea. When Buddhism went to China, they received a tremendous corpus of Indian Buddhist texts. I mean, you wouldn't be able to read them all if they're in English if you had, I don't know, 10 lifetimes. It's a phenomenally big corpus of texts. And so the Chinese had to somehow digest all this, deal with it. They had no sense of context of where it all was historically. They read so much of it, tried to understand of it. And there was a famous Buddhist teacher in China, who was also a great philosopher, and he took it all, and he understood it all, and condensed it all into a little phrase. And the phrase is, liberation invites us from within everything. In everything that you encounter, it's like a little, come here. It's inviting you to come and look, inviting inspection, but there's liberation is to be found. Here, everything invites us to be liberated. Everything invites us to be free. It's to be found there. It's kind of a powerful kind of condensation of this amazingly big religious tradition. And then this onwardly leading, and this is the one I kind of wanted to emphasize today, that the Dharma is onwardly leading. It leads to better and better places. It leads onwards to growth. It leads onwards into the Dharma more deeply. It's kind of like a conveyor belt or something. It points to something, or it's not just this moment. not just about accepting this moment, but there's something about being in this moment that allows things to change and to unfold and to evolve and to move and to grow. And the idea of dependent arising, that things arise because of conditions, means that it's not chaotic. It means that what happens to us unfolds according to conditions. And when we practice the Dharma, we're inserting certain conditions into our lives, which then those conditions allow other things to happen and to grow. Like I talked earlier in the retreat about, you know, the flower that grows. The farmer plants the seed, but then the flower grows. So we plant a seed, and then we do the practice, and then something can grow. It's onward leading. And this points to how sometimes the word Dharma is translated as nature. And the word and the kind of the abstract noun, Dhammata, is translated as natural. The ta means like ness, like dharma-ness. It would be more kind of way we say in English. But dharma-ness is kind of, you know, it's not good English. But yet. But so it's Bhikkhu Bodhi, for example, translated as natural. So keep that in mind here as I read this passage here. You remember about the chicken, right? Who had no intention for the eggs to hatch. She didn't need to have the intention for them to hatch, right? The Buddha said, "For a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted thus. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous." So if you had done nothing to harm anyone, then you have nothing to regret. It's kind of natural that there be non-regret in someone who hasn't caused any harm. That's what the Buddha thought. He hadn't been in America yet. It seems like many of us in America can have the capacity to feel guilty before we do anything, or feel bad about ourselves, but that's a whole other thing. But the Buddhist point of view is that if you don't do anything, if you live virtuously, then of course you'll have non-regret. So it naturally follows. But then it gets more interesting. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let gladness arise in me. It is natural that gladness arises in one without regret. Might not always feel glad, natural for us that we would feel glad just because we have no regrets. But I think that if you kind of can reflect on how good it is, especially if you've been under the burden of regrets for a long time, to have it just finally free, it's a kind of gladness or satisfaction or appreciation that can arise. The tradition also talks about the same way about the hindrances. That once the hindrances are no longer grabbing us and they've abated for a while, there's a gladness that can arise or satisfaction. Oh, that's good. I've been working for days on the retreat, caught up in my mind streams. And finally, those mind streams are no longer caught me and I'm really here. It feels so good. And so the gladness can arise, or you can allow gladness to arise, or some kind of. But for the Buddha says so, for one without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let gladness arise in me. It is natural that gladness arises in one without regret. And then he goes on, for one with gladness, it is natural that joy arises. It is natural that the body becomes tranquil in one who is joyful. For one whose body is tranquil, it is natural to feel happy. For one who is happy, it is natural that the mind is concentrated. For one who is concentrated, it is natural to know and see things as they are. For one who knows and sees things as they are, it is natural to become disenchanted and dispassionate. For one who is disenchanted and dispassionate, it is natural to realize knowledge and vision of liberation. So it might seem kind of far-fetched and strange for many of us to hear this kind of language, that you know, it's natural, just you don't have to intend to have these things happen. But it points to how the tradition understands that there is a natural process that unfolds, that we put together certain conditions. It might not be these conditions for any one of us, but we put together certain conditions, there starts to be an onward leading movement. We're supported, we're carried, we're held. There's something else going on here than our own, you know, efforts. And our efforts are important, but there's something, you know, something else bigger here, that bigger thing going on. So much so that I think that through my own practice, and also I've been a teacher for, you know, many years now, met with many, many people in support of their practice, that I come to appreciate that more often than not, the Dharma knows better than you do what's supposed to happen. That we have all these ideas of what we think is supposed to happen on retreat, or what we think was supposed to happen in our practice, what we think is supposed to be experiencing, or, you know, and the Dharma might have a completely different idea for you, and it knows better than you do. And so to trust that, to trust that process. Sometimes what comes up is very difficult material, all kinds of difficult stuff. There can be rage. There can be deep loneliness and fear. There could be, I've known people who've come to retreat in order to look at their fear and said, but it didn't come. I was happy instead. They felt gypped. So the heart knows, maybe in a more colloquial English, the heart knows better than you do what needs to happen for you. So to trust your heart, what unfolds and what comes. And for me to say it, I think it's a little this kind of way, but I don't know how many of you know me well enough, but I think I'm a very rational Dharma teacher. You know, I kind of want to demythologize everything. So I have no shortage of, you know, so it's a little unusual for me to say this, so I almost can't say it without doing a little bit of rationalizing why it's okay to say this. The analogy or the example I like to use, I've used it many times, I apologize, those of you who hear it more often than you care to, is that of, if you cut your finger, you can be in the kitchen down here and you nick your finger, it bleeds or something. Your job then is to keep it clean. So you might clean it and put a Band-Aid over it or something. And you don't go down and work in the garden or the compost pile, or last retreat the sewage line spilled over, so you don't go down and help with that. You know, you keep it clean and protect that. It's just an important job. You have your role. But it's something that's bigger than yourself, something inside of you that's bigger than yourself that knows how to do the healing. That it's a complicated, sophisticated, biological, physiological, hormonal, electrical event for the body to know how to fix a little cut, to heal it. Probably, if we had to do it consciously and direct all the little things that have to happen, and so you go over that way and this way, and the immune system and this and that, and, you know, probably our little conscious mind is not smart enough for it. But the unconscious mind has, or the subconscious world, or the inner world, that knows what to do usually. And so it unfolds, it heals. I believe the same thing happens to us psychologically, that there are forces of healing operating within us, in our hearts, within us. Forces that within us that knows the movement towards liberation, towards freedom. And if we kind of give it a chance, if we kind of allow or open up and trust something that's not just our own efforts, then it's easier for that inner healing or inner movement towards freedom to operate. So this onward leading of the Dharma, it's the onward leading, it goes somewhere to freedom, to healing of all kinds. And my hope, and partly what I've staked my life on in terms of being a Dharma practitioner and a Dharma teacher, is that it's onward leading not just for the individual, but also for our society. That somehow this is a force towards healing in our society as well. So I don't know if we want to, you know, this thing I just read about it, it's natural if you have, you know, to, if you have, if you're virtuous, to have no regret. If you have no regrets, you can feel glad. It's just the natural flow. It'd be interesting for each of us, each of you, to write your own version of this, rather than taking this as being, you know, the official version of it. But, you know, what would you say? It's natural. Without any volition, if you sit down quietly and sit upright, that your shoulders will eventually soften a little bit. It's natural that as your shoulders and your tension, your body begin to soften, it's natural that you'll start noticing you know, how busy your mind is. As you notice how busy your mind is, it's natural at some point that you begin feeling like, I don't want to do this so much anymore, back off. And as you back off from your being so caught up in your mind, your thoughts, it's natural that maybe you get disinterested in having all these thoughts. And as you get disinterested in some of these thoughts, it's natural that you don't get so distracted by them. As you're not so distracted by them, it's natural that you start getting more stable and settled here. As you become stable and settled here, it's natural that you become more aware of here. As you become more aware of here, it's natural that, you know, so you, anyways, I'm just making it up here on the spot. But it'd be an interesting exercise for each of you to consider if there's any reference point that you have in your own life of this natural process of how things can unfold and move in the practice. But be careful that you don't think that it's all going to be understood. That the way that the Dharma protects us, is onward leading, supports us, holds us, it's not necessarily always, even though the quote says the Dharma is always is visible, the way it protects us, the way it unfolds, the process of conditioning that goes on, is not always obvious how it works. So those who live by the Dharma are protected by the Dharma. So how do we live by the Dharma? And there's one of the answers is called the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is something that when we enter into the path and practice it and grow and develop in it, that at some point, the idea is that we become the Eightfold Path. So it's not like a path out there, it's not like this thing that we do, but it becomes what, you know, what we do intentionally in a sense, but it becomes what we do because it's our character, it's who we are. It's like, it's become so innate to us that we are the Eightfold Path. That's kind of the goal. And so, but in doing that, it isn't that you're supposed to change into something that you're not exactly, but there's something about the Eightfold Path that is who you are when you're at peace, when you've overcome all the inner conflict and angst and turmoil, when we've opened up and settled down, really become something about really become who we are. then the Eightfold Path is who we are. So maybe I'll try to explain what I mean by this as we go along. There's the Theravada tradition, the early tradition talks about, you know, you become the path, the Eightfold Path. In Zen, they say it a little differently. They say, when you're you, Zen is Zen. So the idea that who you are is important. And really, the idea is to become yourself in some kind of way. Mostly by shedding all the ways that you're not yourself. And when you shed all the ways you're not yourself, then the Eightfold Path will probably be there. So there was a story that the Buddha told that he said that there was someone who worked in the woods, and that person went off to work one day and was doing the work in the woods, in the jungle, and went to a place in the woods in the jungle where it was overgrown, and then discovered there was a little traces left of an ancient road. And so the person then kind of went and followed the traces into deeper and deeper into the jungle, the woods. And there, at the end of the path, maybe like how they've discovered whole cities in Central America that have been covered over by the jungle there, the wood person found this capital, this ancient capital and palaces and that had been overgrown and long forgotten. The person came out of the woods, went to the monarchs of the realm, and said, "Hey, there's this ancient road, and it leads to this great capital and palaces." So the monarchs set off with workers, and they clear the road, and they find the palace, the capital, they clear it, and everyone's happy ever after. So the Buddha says, then in telling the story, it's an analogy, and he says, in the same way, I have discovered an ancient path that's been long overgrown, the Eightfold Path. So the Buddha's not saying he invented it, but rather it's already there, it's been kind of hidden from view. And the Buddha has discovered there's this great place to go, this great palace, great wonderful place to come to, the end of that path. And he's come out of the woods, after that discovery, to tell the monarchs of the realm about it. And I love this part of the story, because guess who gets to be the monarchs? It's you. I think this is points to a degree of respect and valuation that the Buddha and Buddhism has for individual people, for who we are. It's so easy with this teaching of not-self to somehow take it, interpret it to mean like not supposed to count. Whereas actually I think it's the opposite. We really count. We're the monarchs. The certain dignity and value in being alive and being a person. And then we shed all the ways that we're not ourselves. Conceit. Holding on to identification. Even being attached to being a monarch is a problem. It doesn't mean we can't stop being kind of this valuable, dignified person. And then we also, our task also is to clear the debris, clear the path. So the Eightfold Path is waiting there. It's been there for centuries, millennia, ages, and so we clear it. And so this idea of shedding what's in the way, and a lot of the practice is really about shedding, moving things out of the way, and allowing something to shine, to come forth and be here for us. So conventionally, the Eightfold Path are practices that we do that work together to create this onward movement that moves us towards growth in the Dharma, moves us towards freedom. And so they are things, so the first one is right view, right understanding, which can mean a variety of different things. Andrea talked about it yesterday some. to understand the Four Noble Truths, to understand suffering and how to be have a wise relationship to suffering as opposed to a relationship that gets us more suffering, to relate to suffering so that there's less suffering. To understand the degree to which our experience in the moment is ephemeral and changing and impermanent. It's a very powerful part of right view. To see that clearly, so there's kind of not holding on to anything or resisting something, or there's a freedom to be found in the midst of impermanence. There is right intention, which means to have we have our part to play. You know, this thing about the natural flow doesn't mean that we don't have our role. And part of that role is to enter with the right attitude, an attitude which is supportive for this whole, provides the supportive conditions for this unfolding to happen. And the three attitudes that are considered supportive for it all are, the first one is a very scary word for people in the West, is renunciation. But the word is kind of a wordplay on the word for lust, because it also looks like, I don't know if it's literally so etymologically, but it looks like it's the same thing as saying absence of lust. So renunciation has a lot to do with not necessarily giving up things, but giving up our lust for things, our clinging, our grasping. And without giving up some kind of strong compulsive drive and desire, we don't have the room in the hearts for the unfolding to happen, the onward moving to happen. So there's some degree of letting go and making space. The second attitude is non-harming, to live a life of non-harming, ahimsa. And I think it's a powerful concept. And some people say it's one of the most powerful forces that exist, is the force of ahimsa. Martin Luther King translated ahimsa into English as soul power. Or no, actually, that was satyagraha, so the power of truth. But anyway, the connection between Martin Luther King and the ahimsa movement of India is very strong. And then compassion, loving kindness, compassion, that these attitudes, or these intentions, these wishes to how to live our life are very powerful. It's very powerful, even if we can't do them, but they're hard to do sometimes, to want to do them makes a difference. And even if we can't do them, don't shortchange yourself by saying, since I can't do it, I'm not going to want to. Even wanting to, in an open-hearted, non-critical way, is creating a condition for, I think, a profound change. And then there's right action. So living a life where our actions don't intentionally cause harm to anyone. Don't kill, don't steal, don't cause harm through your sexuality, and don't cause harm through alcohol and drugs. Not lying is not mentioned here because that comes next in its own right step of the Eightfold Path. But so living, having these actions that don't cause regret, actions that don't cause harm, actions that don't in themselves cause us to contract and close down or do a kind of violence to ourselves in the very doing of them. And then there's our right speech. So how we speak is a very important condition for our own welfare and very important for creating a space that allows something to unfold. If we talk in bitter ways or critical ways or spend too much time being cynical or harsh or angry or untruthful, that creates very different conditions for how things unfold for us than if we speak in ways that are kind, caring, honest, supportive, conducive to concord. So much so that some people say that if you can't do those kinds of right speech, then the wisest thing you can do is just be quiet. I don't know if that's always true, but there's something powerful about creating conditions through speech that support this unfolding of the Dharma. So how do we care for our speech to allow this inner life to move? And then there's right livelihood. And so to create a livelihood which we don't harm through our livelihood, cause harm to others. And that's complicated to do in this kind of society we live in, where it's just so interrelated and interconnected. So sometimes we have to kind of do the best we can sometimes. But I think that if, remember some years ago, there was a man practicing at IMC who was a machinist in a very sophisticated machine shop. So they made all kinds of things with this, all the machinery. And his company got an order to make a part for some foreign country, for their air force, for their jet fighters. So he went to his boss in the company and said, you know, I can't do that. Not part of my right livelihood. And the boss said, okay, you don't have to. So that's how he negotiated that, not to cause harm through his work. And then there's what's called a right effort. And right effort is to avoid doing the things that are stressful. Or there's the word that's unskillful, to avoid doing the things that are unhelpful. I kind of like that. Don't do the things which are unhelpful. That's kind of pretty basic. And do the things that are helpful. And in particular, when it comes to right effort, the Buddhism is talking about with your mind, with your inner life. Do those things with your, figure out, to understand and have the discernment, the wisdom, the understanding, to track what goes on in your mind, the movements of your mind, so that you begin moving towards avoiding the things which are unhelpful in there and doing the things which are helpful. Very important distinction. And one of the things that's helpful is to be mindful. So then there's right mindfulness. Practicing that. One of the things that's helpful is concentration, the stability or the composure or the coming together, being settled. And so practice concentration or develop this ability to get concentrated. And those are the right, those are the eight steps of the eight factors of the Eightfold Path. And I think it's a wonderful thing to spend times of our life focusing on any one of them. Maybe over time, maybe over a year, over 8 years or something, you really kind of focus on each one and really kind of make them become stronger in your life and let them become supportive conditions for this growth and development. And when they become mature, then there's what's called a tenfold path, and that includes right vision, the real deep insight into experience, into our lives, and then right liberation, freedom. Real freedom of the heart, deep letting go. And then when there's enough letting go, enough shedding of all the things which are extra, and I love the word shedding, all the stuff that's extra, all the stuff that keeps us stuck, because for me, I liken it to a snake that grows bigger and bigger. And as the snake grows, it sheds its skin. So as we grow in the Dharma, as we develop, again, it's not a matter of becoming less, you know, becoming a nobody. It's like growing. And the image of a snake is used for someone is a naga, the great snake serpent, is used in Buddhism as a symbol for someone who's awakened. It's the idea of being strong. Last time I talked about the lion's roar. And here is this powerful naga snake. So there's not any doubt that this ancient Buddhist tradition they saw that liberation is this growth and development is something that's the strength and power that comes with it. But there's also freedom. And that freedom can be experienced by peace. Some people associated with a profound sense of peace. That's my association with it. Other people have other associations that different people experience maybe differently. I'm also very fond, as many of you know, the idea of ease. So a sense of the heart at ease, the breathing's at ease, the body's at ease, the mind's at ease. To have a sense of ease in what we do. And my hope is that as the practice works on you, develops in you, that you have a reference point for what I'm about to say. Because I talked about how that we become the Eightfold Path. We become the Dharma. And that is that for people who have a strong enough sense of peace or ease, then we see something happens in front of us, and we might see the impulse to want to grab a hold of it, to crave it. But the reference point to that peace is so strong that there's no inclination to mess it up. Why would you kind of cover it over or destroy it? It would be natural to just stay in that peaceful place. So when I stepped forward to try to break up that fight, I was coming from a place of ease. So staying peaceful doesn't mean that you don't, you know, just sit back and, you know, enlightened retirement. You know, but so come forward. When you have this peace, some modicum of it, why would you get caught up in, again, with lust that closes you down? Why would you get violent when the very violence tears apart your inner insides? Why would you be cruel, uncompassionate, when you can see what a tremendous cost it does for this inner life that's so beautiful and so nice? I think it's kind of, you have something that's so wonderful, that why would you? And the same thing with right action. It's not like you have to do right action, do ethics. It's more like, why would you ever be unethical? Why would you kind of step forward when there's this place, this reference point inside that's so strong? Why would you have wrong speech, lie, and harsh speech, and divisive speech when you have this reference point? Why would you have livelihood that causes harm to others? Again, when it's such a big cost. And then right effort. There also, you know, you have the reference point. You really know. You know, so it's like you have, you spend all this time cleaning your nice white shirt. It's completely clean and white. And so you kind of fold it up nicely and keep it clean, perhaps. You don't kind of immediately go and put it on and go into the kitchen to make the messiest, dirtiest kind of cake you possibly can, with you kneading the batter with your hands and wiping yourself on the shirt. You know, when it's so clean and nice, it's kind of nice and fresh looking. You kind of take care of it. So right effort, when you have this clean inner slate, why would you kind of mess it all up after getting it clean? You do what you avoid, which is not helpful. You avoid what's unhelpful. You do what's helpful. And right mindfulness also comes out of this natural place. Because why wouldn't you be aware? Why not be present when being present and being aware is so much better than alternative? And if all these things together, you know, why would you get distracted? Why would you get caught up in all kinds of swirl of thoughts and ideas? Of course you'd be somewhat concentrated or settled or present here. So that was my attempt to try to explain how when we get to be ourselves, we're so settled and no longer in conflict with ourselves, no longer arguing with ourselves or with opposition within ourselves or closed down against ourselves. We've learned to open up and allow what's there, the Dharma within us to express itself, or the Dharma within us have a chance to show and process all that needs to be processed. And we go through this onward leading movement, the supportive movement of the Dharma as it supports us and moves us and develops us and grows us. Then at some point we get to be ourselves. And when we're really ourselves in some settled, real way, my hope, my expectation is that then you'll find that the Eightfold Path describes who you are, describes how you are in the world. It's not a practice that you have to do. But until that day, it's a great, they're great practices. They're practices that are provide the supportive conditions for the Dharma to work through you. Those who live the Dharma are supported by the Dharma. Those who live the Dharma are protected by the Dharma. And so how do we live the Dharma? Something like the Eightfold Path. Those are conditions that allows something else to operate through us. So to take refuge in the Dharma, to have trust or confidence in the Dharma, has very powerful connotations and meanings. That something, there's something here, something inside of you that's bigger than you. Something inside of you which is not yourself will support you, hold you, lead you onward, free you, heal you. If you trust the Dharma will care for you. Let's take a minute to get resettled.